What you heard was an IRIB.
The headlines. Aid agencies call for global support for 18 million Afghans in need of humanitarian assistance due to conflict, droughts, and the coronavirus pandemic. The Venezuelan government and the opposition reached partial agreements during talks in Mexico City in a step towards ending a long-standing political crisis. And Cuba starts vaccinating children from the age of 2 against COVID-19, becoming the first country in the world to vaccinate younger children. Hello, welcome. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. Some 18 million people, making up half of the population in Afghanistan, are in need of humanitarian assistance. That is according to the International Federation of the Red Cross and the Red Crescent Societies. The IFRC has blamed the situation on severe drought. This says hardships caused by years of conflict, as well as the pandemic, are to blame. The IFRC has urged international action to help the Afghans in need. The UN has previously warned of a looming humanitarian catastrophe in Afghanistan also. The world body resumed humanitarian flights to the country just last week. Things have gotten difficult to provide aid to Afghanistan after the Taliban seized power there last month. The government is yet to be formed, with many countries still refusing to recognize the Taliban. Britain's opposition has slammed Prime Minister Boris Johnson over the handling of the evacuation from Afghanistan and has called for the sacking of his foreign minister, Dominic Raab.
Mr. Speaker, normally we have a cabinet minister sent to the House to cover for the Prime Minister. But today we have before us the Prime Minister desperately trying to cover for a foreign secretary who should have been sacked weeks ago.
We have a Prime Minister incapable of international leadership just when we needed it most. I know it's uncomfortable. The terrible attacks from ISIS-K highlight the new security threat. The government must act quickly to coordinate international partners to ensure the Afghan government's collapse does not lead to a vacuum for terrorists to fill.
Starmer said the government actions were complacent and wrong. He said that many Afghans, whom he described as eligible for help, were not able to get out. Johnson said 311 people eligible to come to Britain are still in Afghanistan. British lawmakers also lambasted the government for intelligence and leadership failures over the fall of the Kabul to the Taliban. Turkey says it is working with Qatar and the U.S. on operating Kabul airport. Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu says Turkish technicians are in the Afghan capital and are holding talks with Qataris about the airport. Cavusoglu says the Taliban need a more reliable mechanism to ensure security inside the airport. He says that Ankara is in touch with the Afghan group that now seems to be in control of the whole country. The Taliban have asked Turkey to help run Kabul airport after toppling the government in mid-August amid the withdrawal of U.S.-led forces. Turkey has told the group it would take part in the mission unless its units are involved in security. Meanwhile, the Taliban blame U.S. forces for destroying military hardware in Kabul International Airport before their abrupt withdrawal from Afghanistan. The group said the hardware served as Afghan national assets, which should have been preserved for the Afghan people. Amin Alami has more from Kabul.
This is Kabul International Airport, which almost 1 week after the departure of the last batch of U.S. forces from the country, is not yet ready to resume its international flights. U.S. forces have intentionally left behind some military and non-military equipment in different parts of Kabul International Airport, a move that took the Taliban some extra time to make the airport operational for domestic flights.
Now we are inside a vehicle of the special unit of Taliban known as Badri 313 Special Forces, and we are going to get to the military part of Kabul International Airport.
American Chinook helicopters are seen in the military section of the airport. As seen, the U.S. forces have destroyed the military hardware like this chopper as much as they could. They have done this to dozens of military vehicles like this one. However, Taliban officials say They plan to fix and use all military hardware as much as possible.
The defeat of the US was a great victory to us. We don't care about damaged military hardware because we will either fix and use them or keep them as a lesson to any other invader.
Furthermore, top Taliban officials described the destruction of military hardware by US forces as their last move toward destroying the national assets of Afghans.
The Americans haven't left any usable military hardware in the airport in order to limit our capabilities, but our nation will go ahead and rebuild their country's infrastructures again.
Despite the fact that the US has damaged the airport, the Taliban say they have already managed to attract foreign investments, mainly from some regional countries, including Qatar and Turkey, to rebuild the hardware to make the airport operational once again. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The Lebanese are bidding final farewell to Sheikh Abdel Amir Kabbalah, the former Speaker of the Supreme Islamic Council of Lebanon. We are joined by Mariam Saleh, who's at the site of one of these events that are taking place to mark his passing away. Mariam, tell us where you are at and what we are witnessing.
Well, I'm at this moment at the Higher Islamic Shia Council, and this is one of the halls that is inside the council, and this is called the Lebanese Unity Hall. And this is as Sheikh Abdel Amir Kabbalah called it, and he wanted it to be as such. He wanted it to be a congregation for all Lebanese of all factions and all sects and all religions to come together. And it seems that his dream and his preaching has come true today, with people and factions and representatives and officials from all factions, people from all religions and all sects coming here to pay their condolences to the Supreme Shia Council and also to his family, who is here also accepting respect and accepting condolences. Just 2 minutes earlier, we saw the coffin of Sheikh Abdel Amir Kabbalah come into this area where we will see the prayers. And as you can hear right now, the recitation of the Quran just before the prayers that will be done over the coffin of Sheikh Abdel Amir Kabbalah, after which we will have two speeches, one for the deputy head of the Supreme Shia Council and the son of Sheikh Abdel Amir Kabbalah, who is also a cleric. He is the mufti of one of the areas in South Beirut, and he will be giving a speech, of course, to speak about this loss and this very heavy loss. As you know, we have condolences coming in from all over the world, in addition to the supreme leader of Iran's revolution, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who also came with his condolences specifically to Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, saying that this is a great loss for the Islamic nation, and this is a personality that has always called for unity among not only the Lebanese, but also among the Arabs and the Muslims, and was considered very significant, of course, in his stances. And he is perhaps considered one of the last remaining clerics of his time in this modern age, you know, the age of Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Abdullah, the age of Sayyid Omar Musali, the age of Sayyid Musa Sadr. So all of those clerics have passed away, and he remained to follow in their footsteps, and hoping that today the other clerics of the next generation will be following also in his footsteps. We are waiting, of course, any moment now to start the funeral procession after the speeches, where he will be buried in one of the cemeteries, which is also very much symbolic. It is called the Two Martyrs Cemetery, which is significant, where most of the martyrs of Hezbollah and the resistance are also buried in that cemetery.
Thank you for that, Mariam Saleh. We do appreciate it. We just got caught up also, but that's Mariam Saleh there. May he rest in peace, marking that event that she was at. Kabbalah's passing away, obviously a very important figure in the Islamic world and beyond. Okay, let's move on with the news. We have the Israeli army chief claiming the regime, quote, has greatly accelerated preparations for action against Iran's nuclear program. Aviv Kakavi said the regime has expanded its military budget just to meet that target, claiming that Israel's current main objective is to minimize Iran's presence in West Asia, with an emphasis on Syria. Last month, Israel issued a similar threat against, quote, a nuclear Iran. Tehran has repeatedly warned that any military move by the Israeli regime would receive a crushing response. Last month, Tehran also informed the UN that the regime's threats are a gross violation of international laws and the UN Charter. Okay, this is part of our news review program. Let's bring in our analyst, Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, analyst, and author, joining us from London. Ryan Dawson is an activist and commentator, joining us from Osaka. Okay, I'd like to welcome you both. Marcus Papadopoulos, first over to you. We have heard about Israeli threats against Iran for decades at this point, but this would be maybe one of the more significant ones with the new Iranian president that is now in power. Do you think that Israel is, based on one analyst saying, making threats because it feels that the U.S. is pulling out of the region and therefore it needs to make this type of threat to perhaps make these think twice? Is that a possibility? What's your view on it?
Well, it is common knowledge that Israel, together with its patrons, America and Britain, is the principal violator of international law and the United Nations Charter in the world. The very fact that Israel, on a routine basis, violates the maritime waters and airspace of both Lebanon and Syria, and also aided and abetted Al-Qaeda against the Syrian government during the horrendous conflict in Syria, is evidence enough of the dangerously menacing and destabilizing force that Israel is, not just in the Middle East, but also in the wider world. But as regards the threats emanating against Iran from Tel Aviv, I do not believe that the Iranian authorities will be unduly perturbed by these. Why? Because firstly, the Iranian economy and the Iranian armed forces are exceedingly strong, and also the Iranian society is unified. Secondly, Israel and Iran do not share a land border. There is a considerable distance separating both countries from one another, which means that this would pose a logistical nightmare for Israel if it was to conduct and maintain a military offensive against Iran. And thirdly, in 2021, stemming from Russia's intervention, legal intervention in the Syrian conflict, there is in existence today a strategic partnership between Tehran and Moscow. And that seriously augments Iran's national security, because it means that Iran has a strategic partnership with one of the two superpowers in the world, as I just said, Russia. So I believe that Iran, as a result of its military, economic, and societal strength and unity, together with its strategic partnership with the Russian Federation, means that Iran is not going to be overly concerned by the threatening language from Israel. But nonetheless, the Iranian authorities will not be complacent. As regards Israel, of course, Israel would very much like to see America become embroiled in a military conflict with Iran, because the Israelis understand that whilst they might be able to employ hit-and-run airstrikes, so to speak, against Iranian military installations and other sensitive installations in Iran, the Israeli military is simply not in a position to conduct the sort of military offensive against Iran that, of course, the Americans would be able to. So for the for Israeli policymakers, yes, they would like to continue provoking tension in the Persian Gulf in the hope that this would result in a war breaking out between America and Iran, okay, in the hope that the Iranian revolution would be destroyed by the Americans.
All right, so Ryan Dawson, we have another Israeli threat leveled against Iran. Perhaps maybe you could connect the dots for us if you feel that that is something that should be presented here between Naftali Bennett's visit to the White House, what the U.S. told Bennett, the way that Biden stands on Iran, all these factors put together, including the, I don't know if it's still really going to happen, the JCPOA or the so-called nuclear deal at this point. Any of these, if the dots can be connected, and if not, then what do you make of the threat?
Well, the threat is mostly hot air. However, Israel has already been attacking what they call Iranian targets or Shia-backed militia in Syria, but in a very ineffectual way. Most of their air attacks are not doing much damage. Most of them are intercepted by Russian anti-air defense in Syria. Israel's real aim here is to disrupt the nuclear agreement. They like that Iran has sanctions, and Iran is skirting a lot of sanctions through the black market means. And so what they really want, and you can see this, the pretext that they've given and stories they've given about mines and ships being attacked, they want to get the Americans to police the waters. And their excuse will be, well, Iran is breaking these sanctions. Iran is supplying Hezbollah, Iran is supplying this group or that. And this is a way that, since the Israelis can't police the waters, they can get the Americans to do so. And the pretext will say, well, if this Iranian ship fired upon this Israeli ship or this oil tanker, they never provide any evidence. This is just accusations. But if they come up with enough accusations, it will give a pretext for the Americans to start seizing ships, not only in the Gulf, but as far as away as Venezuela, to say, well, you know, these are these accusations, so we have to seize these boats to make sure there aren't weapons or this and that on it, to disrupt the Iranian economy. But really, the threat of a hot war with Iran is insane. Israel doesn't have the means. America has the means, but it doesn't have the public will, so it's not going to happen. So they're trying to harass them on maritime trade. They're already attacking their weak points in the periphery in Syria, and they can hardly do any damage there. So it's mostly hot air for budgetary justifications and to try and manipulate America to move the Zionist hand for them.
Thank you for that. Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, activist, and author. Ryan Dawson, a pleasure to see you, activist and commentator from Saka. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. The Venezuelan government and opposition say that they have reached a partial agreement to address people's needs, especially in battling COVID. The parties say that they agreed, among other things, to form a national board of social care to address the areas of health and food. Venezuela's government and the opposition made the announcement following talks in Mexico. They said that they will return to the table at the end of the month. The talks that are mediated by Norway aim to end a political crisis caused by disputed elections more than 2 years ago. During this time, the Western-backed opposition sought to oust the government. That led to Western sanctions that Caracas blamed for people's suffering. The opposition is about to end an election boycott if fresh polls are held in November. And that is for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
simple question.
In 2010, Greece effectively became insolvent. Its national debt skyrocketed, businesses collapsed, and Athens could no longer service its spiraling debts. The European Union offered to help Greece avoid total bankruptcy, but at a price. Financial support from the International Monetary Fund and, crucially, European creditors required spending cuts and increased tax revenues. Greece agreed, but there was widespread anger amongst the public. Many felt that Greece had sold its independence in exchange for survival in the European Union. In the 2015 elections, the Syriza movement won power largely as a result of anger at the previous administration. Yet the new administration also found itself forced to continue with austerity. Today, Greece is more stable, but has a huge debt to pay. Some suggest this makes Greece feel and look like it's no longer in control of its own destiny. While it may seem attractive to be a part of the comparatively stable Eurozone, the loss of sovereignty is strongly felt across the land. There is concern this could lead to an increase in tensions, eroding the ability of the EU to be stable as a whole. How does the population here in Greece, from home and abroad, feel about the relationship between Greece and the European Union? And do they even regard Greece as an independent country, or does Brussels control them? Simple questions with important answers. And let's begin with a central question. How does the public feel about the state of the Greek economy? We put that question to the people in Greece. Here's what they said.
Unfortunately, I don't have much data because I'm just on vacation. I have very few information. I understand that in the last years they had some problems. They were near to be in default. They have some problems giving money back, to Germany. But I have no real idea right now what is the current state of the Greek state of economy.
I think it's not very good because of the thing with coronavirus. But about tourism, the island and all the islands I know, they are very, very, very busy. So if I speak about myself, I am going very well. People I know, they also go very well. But other people I know generally in Greece, they probably have a little bit more problems if they are not connected with tourism.
I think the Greek government, the last 2 years, when they changed the Greek government, take a good rules from the Greece. It's the Greek economy going up day by day.
Now it's changing because every year we come here, and now it's most good. I've been in 5 years ago here first time. It's very poor. Now it's better. So I think it's going up.
Every country owns money, yeah. It's not Greece, it's not... Okay, the economy since 2013 has changed a little bit. The people have... what does it mean? If you buy something and you don't get the... how do you tell it? To pay for the country. You buy a coffee here and they don't give you a... yeah, exactly. And that's changed, and now I think it's going better.
I think the Greek economy is now... improving, having been through a very serious crisis. I think what's happened this year has set the economy back quite a lot. I'm talking about both the COVID pandemic and also the very destructive fires that are taking place in Greece. I think both of these will have a serious effect on the Greek economy. So I think the recovery was underway, but I think it's taken a step back. This point?
I feel very, very bad. I feel like, I don't know, I live in Greece, but we feel very, betrayed somehow. Yeah, because of bad politics and bad economy.
We're in the middle of an international crisis, and it seems to me that the Greek government is coping quite well with the relatively difficulty in terms of the state of the economy, growth, and the state of the business as it is at the moment. It has taken effective steps towards alleviating the pain from the loss of business income from last year, and it has helped quite well the private sector to recover during 2020-2021. Now, Greece has one of the most well-educated populations in Europe, and with a few further measures, we hope that the Greek economy will grow, because Greeks are very creative and very hardworking.
What do people here think of the rules enforced by the European Union to make Greece cut its expenditure?
I think restricting the flexibility of the Greek government is a minor sign. I think the current government knows where to allocate resources and what to do with the financing of the key sectors of the Greek economy. I think if EU wants to assist the Greek economy to recover, it needs to be more flexible with the needs of the Greek government, and needs to see into the propositions that the effective ministers are making towards to Brussels, towards financing plans.
I don't know specific what those rules are, but up to a certain extent, it's okay to impose some rules if you give like a large amount of money. Yeah, you cannot go. There are some boundaries which you shouldn't cross, but because Greece should still remain like an independent state, like a sovereign state. But definitely, if you give a big bag of money, you should try also to impose some rules. It's nothing goes for free, ever. You can't have your cake and also eat it, you know?
I think no, because now, how you say, it's a lot of cutting. So I think, but Greece do it some years ago. They don't show the real economy things, how what happening in the country. So I think it's like a big debt and the sun. So they splash it every time.
I do feel very negative about it. We do have to learn from European Union a lot of things, but generally negative. I wish I could explain you more detailly, but I can't on English. But in generally negative.
I don't have a very strong opinion about it because I'm not that well informed. But I do feel that in many cases the EU has overstepped the mark. It's taken excessive measures to regulate its member states. In some cases, I feel that it's necessary for the EU to intervene. I wish it would intervene more in Hungary than it does at the moment. But in the case of Greece, maybe it has acted a little bit too strictly and too negatively.
I think it's not okay for all the things they can do. I think it's some reasons it's good to say the European Union, but they leave us a little free for some rules, not all for the European Union. But I think the European Union, it's something good for all the Europe, for not like this, for this moment, something like, I think it's something different for the, with the different rules. Sometimes going inside to the governments and said some things is not good. Sometimes the rules they can take, it's good. It's 50-50.
I don't know. I really can't answer that question, honestly. That's a tough one. I don't really want to. I don't know. I think, yeah. I think because England left the EU, that's put a big dent in Europe. A massive dent. And I was shocked that actually voted leave. But, yeah, I mean, I think they'll be okay. I think Greece will come back, just like Ireland's come back. Ireland's come back from pretty much.
To be honest, I don't know very well. I cannot answer very well in this question. But what I have understand through my life is that all these people from Europe, from the West system, they are losing control because they think only about numbers. They don't care about reality. They don't care about the point of life, of human, of earth, of everything. They only care about money.
More generally, how do people visiting, staying, living or working in Greece feel about that important relationship between Greece and the European Union?
I understand they got a bailout, but then so did a lot of other countries, you know. And at the end of the day, is it Greece's fault? No, it's not Greece's fault. It's the way of the world, it's the economy, it's a lot of things. It could be corrupt politicians, could be the problem, I think, personally. Friendship, I think the friendship's okay, actually. It could be better, but at least they're making progress.
I know, I understand that we took a lot of money, and somehow we must pay for that. But people didn't knew what they're doing 20 years ago. Yes. A bad choice of political, it's not what we pay now.
I think it's always good relationship. We always need them and they need us. It's okay. I remember so many meetings. I have worked so many business and all the meetings all the time. It's always about money, about numbers, not about the point. When I work, I try always to do my work the way that the people that I sell what I sell, they are very, very happy. It's giving, it's something that comes from my soul, and I don't see that around.
I think Greece has a lot of possibilities for strengthening its relationship with the EU. I hope that it will show the political leadership that's necessary in order to exploit the opportunities that it has, but time will tell.
Since I'm a tourist and I'm not really familiar with what happens in Greece, I can tell you things in general. A lot of states, like Greece, like Poland, like Hungary, like Romania, my state, for example, have some national things and some ways to do things that may not be all the time in accordance with European values. But this is normal. You need to keep a balance. You need to also preserve your national identity. But then again, we are in a big family and we all can see the benefits. I for sure can see the benefits of the states, especially the poorer states being in the EU.
I think the relationship is quite strained because of the Greek debt crisis and the austerity that has occurred since 2011. I think by being more flexible in terms of financing progress in Greece, I think people will become more friendly towards the Brussels rule. The relation was strained because when you restrict budgets and cut people's available disposable income, creates problems in society, which are need to be addressed by the local government. So the local government needs assistance of Brussels, and to some extent, this has not happened at the point where the Greek society wanted. So But Greeks are people who are forgiving and willing to work very, very hard to progress in life. And if things become a little bit more friendly between Brussels and Greece, I think there will be no problem with the Greek society being in Europe.
The crisis and austerity measures created unemployment reaching 25.4% in August 2012. Since 2010, various European authorities and private investors have loaned Greece nearly 320 billion euros. So far, despite the hardships, Greece has only repaid around 41 billion euros. At the current level of repayments, Greece will be in debt to EU partners and others until beyond the year 2060. What, if anything, should change about the Greece-EU relationship? Is the public's opinion.
Change the Greek government, probably.
Actually, it's the democracy. There is no democracy anymore. I don't see any democracy. Everything it's about, any decision they make, it's about the rich people, how they... So I call it a rich democracy. This is not a democracy. They only care about themselves. So this is what Greeks, they do, actually, also. But and I, for me, it's I have a totally different opinion about life, because I understand, since I changed my mind and I think this way, how can I be better, how can I be nice and good to the other, even if they are customers or normal people, I see that my life goes much, much, much better with that thinking, because I always have luckiness in my life. But when you are only money, I see generally in my life then bad luckiness. So I follow this.
I just think people have... I think the big problem is people don't talk, people don't communicate. People need to sit down and bang a few heads, like no more than done back in the peace agreement. She done it. She sorted it out. The problem is people don't like change. That's the big problem. But you have to go with the times. I go with the flow. You have to go with the flow. You don't go with the flow, you'll either sink or you'll drown. You know, but yeah, I think we just need to sit down and then. You see, the problem is you've got the big players there, haven't you? You've got Germany, who are pretty much running Europe when it comes to the euro. Because, I mean, they did bail out.
Look, the Greece have many problems for the, for the Turkish, with all the neighborhoods. I think the European Union helped the Greece for this moment. It's not good to change something. That is the big reason. And that's the big problem of Greece. They can't take off the European Union. It's good for us. We have a project for the European Union.
Here's another big question. What will happen to Greece and its future independence in terms of its relationship with Brussels?
From the bottom of my heart, I wish it become independent someday. Yes.
If Brexit didn't happen when things were really, really bad for the Greek economy, I don't think now things are recovering, and I don't think it is in the interest of the Greek society to leave Europe. I think we are in the heart of Europe, and we are the heart of Europe, and all the Greeks know that. And as soon as the economic indicators recover, I think the Greeks will never, ever, ever ask to have a Grexit. I think the relationship between Brussels and Athens are relatively strained now, but the Greek society knows where their heart is, and that's in Europe.
I don't think Grexit is likely to happen in the near future. I think Greece's future is very firmly within Europe and within the European Union.
No, I don't think we have in this time thing like that can happen. No, I don't think. Not just because countries, human beings, and this, they are very weak to do something like that. We need support. If things was different, and things to be different, actually, for my opinion, is the schools from the beginning, 6 years old, they have to change. They have to learn first respect. When you find out respect, then you can do anything you like. Now, the way I see human beings, they are very weak to be independent.
No, it's impossible. Maybe not now, maybe 20 years, more or less, after 20 years. Now, I think it's impossible because it's a lot of money, how they give away. About 50 years, 50 years. Maybe something changed. Now it's not independent.
Depends very much on how you see the things. There is no country with no national debt. So owing money, it's right now, it's the standard, it's the way to be. There is no other way. To what extent you own money and to who you owe money, yeah, you have to regulate this. And you have to be able to stay within boundaries. I'm sure that European Union and Greece will come to some terms, and things will eventually go to a normal state.
Greece has been forced to make huge cuts to its public services, state benefits, and economy to try and reduce its debts, all because the European Union and others told them to. There were demonstrations and even a change of government, but this didn't change much at all. Greece had to follow orders, and with no prospect of paying back the massive debt anytime soon, it remains obedient and to some extent controlled by European politicians. Now people are unhappy because they feel Brussels, not Athens, is running Greece. But they know there's nothing they can do short of revolution, leaving the EU, or both.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi,
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. Previously, we started talking about the notion and the concept of corruption and how it demines the value of a human rights and basically deprives the humans of their right through corruption itself. We spoke about the definition of corruption and what it means to be corrupted and the branches of power that corruption falls on. That's something that you can return to if you have extra time to spare. Today, we want to see how far was corruption documented, or when was it documented, to be precise. The earliest record of corruption dates back to the 13th century BC, to the time of the Assyrian civilization, from the found plates written in cuneiform, where archaeologists managed to decipher and discern how people back in the day were accepted bribes. So it dates all the way back to the 13th century BC, where it was written in stones of how people used to accept bribes, which in fact influences the people in power to do something for their personal gain, which deprives others of their right. So if you have money, you can buy your way out of things by taking the rights of others, obviously. So that dates back to 13th century BC. Even under the Roman law, the criminal offense of corruption was defined as giving, receiving, or claiming benefits in order to influence an official in connection with his work. So let's assume there's a man in power and you want to get somewhere and you have to go through that person. So you, whether it is giving, you have to give him money, or sometimes taking from him. Sometimes the person might say, well, I'll give you this if you give me that. In order what? To receive benefits, to influence that person in this position to do what you do. And we see this happens in our daily life, be it through trades, businesses, you know, even offices, organizations. Sometimes even we see it in simple things. You want to get a driver's license, for example, and you pay someone off and he gives it to you, for example. And so on and so forth. You want to get a passport done and you pay someone off and you buy a passport. And sometimes even in customs, in the police system, it works everywhere, where you influence someone by giving or receiving to influence their work so they could give you what you require. And due to that definition of corruption in the Roman law, they placed another law. They created a supplementary law which enforces the penalty for doing such damage by doubling the value of the damage. So if you take something, then what you need to pay is double of that. And the loss of political rights. So if someone is caught, if he's in politics and he's caught dealing in bribes, he will forfeit and he will lose his job in being a politician. That's something that we could relate to, for example, when you look at certain people in high power. You can see they've been caught red-handed dealing in corruption, but because they're too high, no one could touch them, and they go and answer. But back in the day, if such a thing would happen, that person will definitely lose his job amongst other punishment that he might face. Now, let us continue this topic, but after the break.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners, and you are still listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. So we were saying that even though corruption dates back to 13th century BC, the Romans had laws concerning corruption and those who deal in corruption. However, that did not help elevate corruption, especially due to the fact that corruption was most practiced by the members of the Senate or senior officials, both be it in Rome or even in our current times. When it is done on such a scale, when people who are in parliament, in the Senate, or senior officials, it is very hard to put them to question. Not just that, but it is very hard to even find out that they are being corrupted or dealing in corruption to begin with. So even these laws did not elevate, did not solve the problem or solve the issue to begin with. In fact, it just increased the sense of corruption, because once a person in high power is corrupted, all those under him or being corrupted with him, their network spreads and becomes bigger and bigger and larger and larger. So it did not elevate, nor did it help the fact that corruption needs to stop. And even with the fact that, for example, if you look at it from an Islamic perspective or religious perspective, even with the clergy, for example, or the Pope, or you know, those who are in position to educate people, with even they're doing their part in trying to highlight the devastating effects of corruption and how it affects the entire community, the entire society, it doesn't seem to be doing much. And why? Well, obviously the answer is very simple, because when it comes to my benefit, I would do whatever it takes, right? Sometimes we turn a blind eye to what happens. I remember a story that happened recently between two of my friends. They were going into a business deal, and they done their business deal and they came back and we were just sitting together. And one of them, so one was the business person himself, and the other guy was just his friend who went with him and he witnessed the deal. So the friend saying, oh, you know what, today this product was out of stock, and the manager was a friend of mine, or he was, you know, we speak the same language or what have you. And he said, you know what? He said, I'm going to take, because they have to divide the product to other cities. He's like, you know what? I'm going to take from other cities and I'm going to give it to you. And, you know, he was very happy, very excited that this manager done this. His friend looked at him in surprise and said to him, did you know what he just did? He said, what? What did I do? He said, he just took the rights of others. Because those people in those cities, those businesses, or those managers, or those businessmen, they go into less products, and less products means they're not going to give to their customers. So you deprive them of their right, and you seem to be happy about it. Me and you, we could be put in a position where it is similar to this, and we think we'd be just being clever, or we have good connections, but the fact is we are just as corrupted as everyone else, and we are taking the rights of others. We will continue talking about this topic in episodes to come. So until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Salli ya Rabbi ala Taha al-Amin, rahmatin arsaltahu lil alamin, wa ala alin nabiyyi ajma'in, fabihim narjuka ahsin khatmina.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.